Welcome to week 9 of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. I'm John Zogby, and wow, what a week it was, wasn't it, Jer?
What a week, what a month, what a year it's been. How about that?
Yeah, that too.
Well, let's get right into it. I'm going to start out with the most obvious question. Everybody was watching the polls. A week before, days before Super Tuesday, consensus was Bernie's the guy. What happened? How do you make sense out of that?
You know, the traditional process played out. As we've been talking about right along, these primaries are a sequential process, and they build upon each other. They winnow out candidates. They have candidates that do better than expectations. And those that do better than expectations get endorsements, and endorsements matter in primaries. And so, I mean, essentially, all Joe Biden had to do in Nevada, which was the last time we talked, was show up. You know, he had to show that he could get some votes, get into second place. As soon as people saw that there were some meat and bones on this character, then things started to play his way. The week running up to South Carolina, we saw his leads go up and up and up and up, 5-9, 11-13, 15, 20 points. And then it was a massacre. And from there, he got a very potent endorsement from really Mr. South Carolina, Jim Clyburn. Jim Clyburn matters. 46% of African Americans who voted in South Carolina said it was the Jim Clyburn endorsement that tipped them towards Biden. And then from there, it was a perfect storm. Pete Buttigieg, you know, who had been doing well, but clearly was not going to go anywhere, the more diverse the electorate became, endorsed. Amy Klobuchar, this is a story. Amy Klobuchar was leading in Minnesota. The poll that came out Monday morning before the Super Tuesday, she had 27%, Biden had 4%. She endorsed him at 10 o'clock in the morning. And by Monday night's polling, Biden is polling 27% and Klobuchar 4%. Beto O'Rourke in Texas really mattered. Biden, we saw his numbers go from a deficit to either a 2-point deficit or a 1-point lead in Texas. You know, the floodgates opened. People are looking for someone to beat. Democrats are looking for someone to beat Donald Trump. And I guess they felt at that point in time that they found him.
So to sum it up, basically, the biggest answer is momentum. Momentum is huge, right? We know that
momentum
from
is huge.
Mm-hmm. We know that from traditionally Iowa and New Hampshire. We're still early in the game, but on top of momentum, it was the endorsement that Biden got in South Carolina. But then, as I'm just kind of summarizing what you said, that the party then rallied behind Biden. But no surprise, you know, we figured, mm-hmm. We talked a lot about that. I have a different take. We'll get to that down the road. But what I want to know is what happened with the 18-29 turnout, mm-hmm. in a lot of these primaries? What are the numbers and how much of a role did that play into Biden's hands, if not?
Okay, it's a nuanced kind of answer, because historically, the turnout of 18-29-year-olds is good. Good, in fact, a very good. But if you measure it against turnout of 18-29-year-olds in the Democratic caucuses and primaries where Barack Obama was involved in 2008 and 2012, then it's a little bit below that. So it's not record setting as Bernie had promised. And so essentially good turnout, And Bernie is doing well among 18 to 29 year olds, 18 to 40 year olds for that matter. But there aren't enough of them to offset someone doing very well among older voters.
Yeah, I wonder if that played a role. It had to have, but you know, we talked about this very key question that mm-hmm. that we think gets at the heart and soul of America and the crossroads that we're at. We asked it in our latest Forbes poll. We asked 18 to 29 year old likely voters, if you had to choose a route in terms of an economic system, that you know the United States would mainly go. Would you prefer the United States to mainly go socialist or to go mainly capitalist? And you know, the results of that question, we had the answer in our fingertips all along, and I didn't even think of it. But just to review, 40% in our poll said that when pressed, they would mainly choose the route of capitalism. 34% said that they would mainly choose the route of socialism. So that spread of 40% to 34% in favor of capitalism, I'm going to make the case is, you know, interestingly, in terms of numbers, is about equivalent to the spread of delegates that Biden has over Bernie. And so I'm not saying that Joe Biden is Mr. Capitalism, but mm-hmm. what I am saying is we know Bernie is Mr. Socialism. So I wonder when it came down to it, and when the people had to go to the polls, and especially even 18 to 29 year olds, they scratched their head, and maybe what they said was, maybe I'm going to choose the much less socialist candidate, not even socialist candidate Biden over Bernie. So that's my take. How do you react to that?
I think you're onto something. I really do. But remember, these are only 18 to 29-year-olds, and if more of them, slightly more of them, favor capitalism to socialism, remember, we got to combine it with the whole, meaning mm-hmm. got to combine it with those 30-plus and those 50-plus who clearly are on the capitalist line. Capitalism wins. So mm-hmm. in perspective, let's just step back for a moment. Bernie is doing very well up until last week. But he's doing well in a 5, 6, 7, 8 person primary, meaning if he's polling 24, 28, or 36%, he's doing very well. But how well is he going to do then in a 2-person race? Last time he did well against Hillary Clinton, but a bigger factor besides socialism, capitalism with Hillary Clinton was Hillary herself. I mean, there were people yeah. who supported Bernie mainly because A, they didn't think he was going to win anyway, and B, they just didn't like Hillary. This time, when the sense is, hey, Bernie can actually win the nomination, that's when I think voters think twice and are finding, I think, what they believe is a decent alternative.
Yeah, and another take on what I said and what you just said goes like this. So the election of Donald Trump, if we put that on a scale of 1 to 10, and the higher the number you go represents the further right you go. And so, you know, we know that Donald Trump is the populist, you could, I guess, call him the reactionary on the right, and he would probably fall somewhere along an 8 or a 9, and probably a lot of people would even say 10. And on the other side of the scale would be the populist left radical, who would certainly be Bernie. That would represent maybe a 1 or a 2. I'm starting to think that Americans, and particularly at this stage, Democrats, were thinking maybe it's not so healthy that America goes from a 9 or a 10 to mm-hmm. a 1 or a 2. I mean, by definition, that's manic depressive, right? And mm-hmm. so maybe it made more sense to them to say, let's go somewhere in the middle. Let's go somewhere in the moderate, on the moderate side, that being Joe Biden.
So what you're saying basically is that there are limits to disruption. You know, maybe what voters may say this year is enough already. Okay, we tried the disruption. Maybe some of us liked that disruption, but now it's time to cool off a little bit. Kind of like what happened to some degree, Woodrow Wilson, the idealist, versus Warren Harding, the anti-idealist. They voted for actually the exact opposite in 1920 to rid themselves of too much vision. In this instance, maybe just too much anxiety caused by the disruption. We'll have to see how that plays out, because frankly, Jer, today, if the election were held in those battleground states that normally were Dem and voted for Trump, you know, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, either Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden would defeat Donald Trump. But we have a whole, 5 months ahead of us, don't we?
It definitely ain't over. Yeah, we don't know. And, I like analyzing this. I like taking all the different angles. You've already kind of alluded to it that about the key word disruption. Maybe enough is enough with disruption. Especially, we can't forget about what was going on in the backdrop with the markets, the Dow Jones. By this point, I think, don't quote me exactly, but I think it's fallen somewhere about 4,000 points. Around Super Tuesday, it maybe had been about 3,000 points. So there's the economic anxiety. There is the coronavirus. People are scared. By the way, as we speak, the fear is in this country. It's within our borders, and it has been even before Super Tuesday. So maybe what alleviated people and drove them to Biden was this backdrop of, we want confidence. We don't want this manic swing. We want a little bit more certainty. Now, you know, maybe I'm looking too far into it, but I can't help but think that's the case. Well, I'll stop right there because I have so much to say.
Yeah. And I do too. Let's take a moment on Bloomberg, if we could, though, in just a moment.
Sure.
This is a good process. I know there's a lot of talk about Iowa and New Hampshire are not diverse and all of that, but I like the process the way it is. And you've heard me say this many times at home, that if you want to be president of the United States, you got to be willing to be in a place that's very cold, a lot of snow, get up at 5:30 in the morning and flip pancakes, shake hands with farmers and with blue collar workers before they go into their plant. You've got to be willing, I've said, not only to humble yourself, but to humiliate yourself. And I think ultimately, I understood to some degree where Bloomberg was coming from. He wanted to defeat Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And what he wanted, what he figured, was that, you know what, I don't think we're going to end up, you know, with these first four contests from Iowa to South Carolina with any clarity on the center lane. So I suppose it was worth the effort, although most of us would have put $200 down to make that effort as opposed to $500 million. But maybe in the final analysis, what Bloomberg did was he got Joe Biden to step up his game. Maybe that's the positive spin on Bloomberg's 2020 legacy. What do you think?
Well, I mean, look at the actions. Biden did step up his game, right? Mm-hmm. As soon as Bloomberg came to the debates, Biden seemed to be on his better game. So that does, that seems pretty accurate. The other thing is that If people have to remember that here we are analyzing these events and we're polling, and people need to remember that this is a snapshot. This is a snapshot in time. Mm. You know, if you look on the horizon and you paint a picture, or you take a picture, you're getting the surface of things, and you're trying to penetrate the surface and understand what's going on. But then time moves on, and all of this could go out the window as new things happen. So we already said this, we still have months to go, and it's not over. What I want to ask about and talk, you know, there's a lot of talk from those who are critical of Biden that they think he's going senile. They point to, hey, look in the earlier debates, if you looked in, zoomed in on some pictures, he had a bloodshot eye. And you were telling me after Super Tuesday for the first time, and I didn't catch this, but you heard him slurring. So, I mean, it begs the question. I mean, we got a long haul to go. Can Biden keep it up? But the same could be said for Bernie, who months ago checked himself into the hospital because of a minor heart attack.
Right. And the same could be said of me as well. So,
well, I'm knocking on wood right here.
Yeah.
That it doesn't happen.
Look, there's no question about the fact that you do slow down. But I'm amazed at the stamina of the four septuagenarians, right? Let's include Donald Trump and Elizabeth Warren as well. You know, before Ronald Reagan, we had never had a president reach the age of 70 before. And now they're getting elected. We've had several in their 70s, and now they're 77 and 78 and running. That's a testimonial to our healthcare system, I suppose, and to good nutrition.
Yeah, and it also begs another question. And by the way, to our listeners, this by no means means that the gloves are coming off. But I want to ask this question. Why are we still ruled by boomers? I think I know, but coming from a boomer, I want to hear, why are we still ruled by boomers?
Well, we do tend to be smarter than everybody else, and unfortunately are going to live long, long lives. But no, that is a very good question. You know, let me parse it, because, you know, I've done a lot of work on age cohorts. The first is that we still were the largest age cohort. So there's a lot that we have not gotten out of our system, and we're living longer and healthier. Frankly, Biden and Sanders are not boomers. They're actually members of the silent or the private generation. Secondly, wow, is that as far as millennials are concerned, they have entered into the political system just as they have entered into the corporate and leadership positions of not-for-profits. But the leadership structures of all these organizations are not geared for millennials. So that's a huge and complicated process that's going to go through. You're not just going to elect a millennial president. You're going to elect a millennial as president who will change the presidency forever. And I don't know that we're necessarily there just yet. But I think it comes back to what we were talking about really at the top of this broadcast. And that is that there has been so much disruption that perhaps in the final analysis, maybe we do need a period of calming down, as they said during the French Revolution, a thermidor. Just slow it down a little bit. Let's get a little bit of stability, regroup, and then prepare for the next wave of change. Just a theory.
Now, we often, or we always, talk about boomers and millennials, and especially when you go on, you know, and give speeches, And I've actually heard this, there was, you remember that one conference call that we had with a potential client, and the woman was just so upset. I'm so sick and tired of hearing about millennials and boomers. What about us Gen Xers? We don't really hear too much about Gen X, although we know because of just sheer age of them being in their 40s and 50s. And of course, by the way, I do believe Obama was a Gen Xer, right? He would be classified as Gen X, right?
Actually, no. He was a very young boomer, believe it or not. He missed the cutoff by a few years, to be a Gen 1961. Gen X, we usually say, is 1965.
65, yeah.
Yeah, but there were aspects of him that were a little bit of both, yeah.
So he was kind of on the cusp. And there is that phenomenon people need to remember with generations, that it's not black and white. There is this little gray area where you can be born on the cusp, like your brother and my uncle, Jim, who is just on the cusp of being the silent. And he's officially a boomer, but there is that difference between the two of you. But back to my question, why is it? Why do Gen Xers, at least in the last few years, seem to not get the spotlight when they're in their prime?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And in fact, for starters, Gen X is a small group. And so much has been made out of the two giant pieces of ciabatta bread that cover the sandwich. I mean, boomers are 78 million strong, millennials 84 million strong. You're probably talking Gen X at about 60 million. They kind of get lost in the shuffle. And so there's that. There's also, and they don't like hearing it, but they've been so busy putting together their own lives. Remember, they were born into an America that was falling apart in many ways, race riots and a losing a war in Vietnam and the commodities market that America couldn't control anymore, and Roe v.
Wade. Skyrocketing divorces,
all of that. Probably too busy in many ways to, be focused on political and corporate leadership institutions.
Fascinating. What about millennials? The oldest millennial is about 39 or 40. Yep. I myself, I'm 36. So I'm a little bit on the older end of the spectrum. Obviously, if you go back to the Constitution, it says that you can be president when, it doesn't say you can be president, but it says that you must be 30, at least 35, right? But that was in the 18th century, and being 35 in the 18th century was a lot different than being 35 in the 21st century. I think I may have already answered my question there, but so let me change course on the question. And, as we older millennials are getting a little bit closer to inheriting positions of leadership, what advice do you have for us in terms of what we could do better? Or are you boomers in your late 60s and 70s? Maybe are you out of touch and can't really tell us because we're coming of age in the 21st century? Which one is it?
First of all, it's a transitional period. This will be the last of the boomers, that will rise to the leadership of the presidency of the United States. But, one of the misunderstandings that we have is we have this cliche these days, okay, boomer, like suggesting that, all right, you just keep talking, you just keep getting in the way, and okay, we'll just half listen. But the sense that I have really is that we boomers are still valued as mentors, that we're still valued as people who have a lot to say and a path to open up and to show. But the reality is that in every aspect of our lives, we really need to segue into a millennial and Gen Z dominated world for technology, if for no other reason, but also for redefining paths to leadership and what leadership looks like and what structures or non-structures work to make decisions that we boomers are just never going to achieve. And so essentially, I think we just have to both continue to be very patient with each other. Just patience. It'll work itself out.
Yeah, I mean, it always has, and it there's no reason to believe that it won't. It always will. But you know, I don't know if I should say I'm on the fence, but maybe I'm in this middle ground territory where on the one hand, I very much look up to boomers because, well, you were a source of inspiration to me when I was studying American history in college. And I, by the way, I was always fascinated by the 60s, just as a little kid, seeing clips of some of the earliest of what were kind of like music, not music videos, but, videos, I guess, clips from TV of the bands that were playing and, the brazenness of boomers to just challenge authority like it had never been done before. Was a really great source of inspiration for me. But, on the other hand, and I think this is always the case with a young and upcoming people, when they reach their late 20s and 30s, and they're so close, and they're getting, I guess the word would be impatient, where well, just give it to me already. But I've always tried to quell that and push it back, because you're the elders, you have more experience, and we just always have to keep that in mind. But yet at the same time, it's like there's a new world out there. So we can learn a lot, and we should learn a lot from boomers. And I would never suggest that boomers should learn anything from millennials. I'm not one of those that would say that, but there's a fine line. But the mentorship part of what you said is very key. And that's how I think in a lot of ways that this business is, that not only are you senior partner, but you're also a mentor. But I mean, what do you think about what I'm saying coming from a millennial, and what would you add, or what would you ask about that?
So much of that is uniquely you. That kind of respect. But by the same token, I have to admit that so many of the myths about millennials, being entitled and assuming that they should be in a better place than they are, I just don't find that to be true. I generally find, not only in the survey research and the focus groups that we do, but also find in the just in my life and observation, that the reality is that there is a lot of patience out there, that there is a willingness to lead and a readiness to wait a little bit. There is a willingness to lead, but there's also a willingness to say, but I'll lead, and I'll lead on my own terms when I'm ready. And so we are, in many ways, I hate to use a cliche, we're in the middle of a transitional period. And transitional periods are not fun. They create an awful lot of anxiety, but we see that we're in the process of destroying old ways of doing things. Technology is creating a whole different set of expectations and skills that we need, but now institutions have to follow. And those institutions are crumbling, to be sure. Where do we go from here, though? That's going to take just a little while.
Well, a good question is, and this will bring our conversation full circle, back to politics and leadership. But every generation has its leaders, has its faces and personalities that become the spokespeople for the generation. And I don't think millennials have those set of people who have emerged just yet. But given, you know, your study of history, and with your age, you know, your ability to look back and then have foresight at the same time, what would be a good set of skills? What would be a good set of attributes that those future leaders of the millennial generation, who come to define the millennials as they get written in history and assume these positions of leadership, what should those be?
You know, I'll defer to Daniel Pink and his book, A Whole New Mind, where we're going to be dominated, not dominated by people, but our world will be dominated by empathy, by ethics, by consensus building, by a horizontal kinds of decision making, as opposed to a distinct pecking order and a singular ruler who rules and others who follow. I think we're heading actually towards not just simply greater democracy, but greater cooperative ways of moving forward. And so those are the kinds of skills I think that millennials are developing already and just need to be honed, because the day is really right around the corner when not only will those skills dominate, but people who are better equipped because they're millennials will lead that kind of a world.
I think if I were to add a little bit to that, I guess what I would say, and this would go for Gen Z as well, that if I could do it all over again, go back to when I was 18, instead of focusing on knowledge and degrees and intelligence, I would have focused more on skills. I would have instead of what classes do I want to take, because that sounds really fascinating, what apprenticeships should I be looking for? What little jobs should I be taking? I would have probably put more of an emphasis on as many part-time jobs and gigs as I possibly could have to build my resume in terms of my skills, and less at my book of knowledge. Because at the end of the day, when you have your free time, you can read books, right? Of course, it's always good if you have a teacher, but in this world of YouTube and the internet and everything at your fingertips, well, they're there, and they're there for free. The other thing that I would say is something that's just age old and is wisdom. For me, and by the way, I feel blessed because I feel that runs in our family. A listener should know, tell them about Jiddu, tell them about my grandfather, your father, and what he was in the village of Lebanon that he where he was from.
Yeah, small little village. He was the sheikh. He was only in his 20s, but everybody went to him, you know, to resolve disputes or to share wisdom. And in fact, when he passed away way too early, his oldest brother said to me, you know, he said, I was the oldest, but when we needed a family decision, we went to Joe. That was Yusuf. That was my father. And I was always very proud of that, and equally proud of the fact that he ran quite a good sized grocery store with his brothers. And that when he passed away, my mother got the contents of the safe. And in that safe was a black ledger book, including pages upon pages of names of people that, I'm putting this in quotation marks, borrowed groceries from Joe during the Depression. And I was proud of that because, You know, ultimately, it is empathy. It is the ability to connect with people. That's what makes you, you know, ultimately a leader. And let me go full circle, and we'll just end right here, that this is going to be a very interesting battle if, in fact, Joe Biden does win the nomination and runs against Donald Trump. And you have a contrast between someone who is perceived to have been entitled, perceived to have been self-centered, and perceived to lack human empathy. And I could actually even quote him on that, saying that about himself, versus someone whose life has been in many ways defined by personal tragedy that I think a lot of people ultimately can relate to. These are not two perfect men, but they are prototypes. That's what's going to make this interesting, if that's ultimately what happens.
So that about does it with our conversation on the domestic side. And every week, we've made sure that we cover the biggest story of what's going on and the international scene. And still, here we are weeks later, and the biggest story getting bigger by, you know, the day, at least a week, is the COVID-19, the coronavirus. And you know, with everything that I've been reading, and there are people who think that the statistics are, you know, are accurate. There are a group of people who think that the statistics are underreported. And then there's an interesting group of people who think that the statistics are overreported. And that's not because of a conspiracy, but because of the statistical methods in which the doctors are testing. One has to remember that, first of all, a lot of nations have a shortage of test kits. People have to remember as well that with this virus, you could test multiple times and show up negative, and then maybe by the fifth or sixth time, positive. And of course, that could lead to a skewing of the results as well as what symptoms you're looking for. Because, you know, the question is somebody dying because of the virus, because of pneumonia, or even tuberculosis, and all of those could be counted. But you could pull your hair out and go bald trying to figure that out and what's going on in the present. And I've just decided to try to understand what's going on or what will happen in the future, because this could be a watershed event. You know, diseases and outbreaks and viruses come and go, but the way that this has been reported and the public reaction with panic and fear, is a signal that this could be a watershed event. So I'm looking to the future, and I'm asking the question, well, what could come ultimately of this? And I want to remind our listeners that sometime during this week earlier, the WHO came out and pointed to the fact that one of the great spreaders of this virus could be cash itself. And that makes sense. Currency, right? I mean, exchanges from hand to hand to hand to hand. Recall, for those who've been following the last maybe 4 or 5 years, that there has been an intense debate among the central banks around the world of the need to get rid of cash because of, you know, it could be fighting terrorism. It could be, it makes it too easy for criminals to go anonymous, but also to, you know, have a digitized or a central bank version of a Bitcoin. And so if I'm going to make a forecast, and I could be wrong about this, I can foresee in the coming months worldwide, or at least a great deal of the world, the end of cash. And so I'll just let you think about that. I don't know whether that's good or bad. That's not my job. I'm just trying to figure out what's happening next. But until then, well, Dad, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think you said it. You made me think. Take care. Thank you.
Take care.